headlines. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, warns of enemies' attempts to weaken Muslim unity and spirituality. The U.S. will deliver a new batch of weapons to Ukraine that can be used to strike Russian targets at a longer range. Also ahead, a curfew is in place in Sri Lanka's capital after protests over a spiraling economic crisis turned violent. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has issued a message on the annual event of the Hajj pilgrimage calling for unity among Muslims. The leader said enemies have long strived to sow division and undermine spirituality among Muslims. Ayatollah Khamenei, however, said that the Islamic world is today ready to foil such plots. He said, "This is due to resistance and the fact that Muslims are more aware of the grand value of their religion." Ayatollah Khamenei said, "There is a large number of young people in the Islamic countries who are energetic and highly motivated." He termed those youth as, quote, "valuable assets in shaping the future of the Muslim world." Also in his message, the leader said that the Islamic Republic is a good example of how Islamic sovereignty, together with people's vote, can form the principles of governance in a country. The leader hailed what he called stability, independence, and progress, and honor of the Islamic Republic as a meaningful phenomenon that can attract the thoughts of every conscious Muslim. Sayyid Mohsin Abbas joined us earlier to give us his thoughts. He says Hajj is a symbol of equality and a stance against opposition.
The problems that Muslims face and the problems, by extension, the West faces, and what's going on in West Asia at the moment in terms of the oppression of Yemen, the oppression of the likes of the Palestinians, the oppression of Afghanistan, you know, all across that region, it's littered with the oppression of Zionists and the imperialists. For the Saudis to reject that obviously is a political move, because they're hand in glove with that very oppression. They're the ones fighting in Yemen. They're the ones funding a lot of the terrorism around that region. They're the ones who give the Americans and the Zionists a foothold in the region. And they're the ones who spread religious ideologies which sectarianize and divide. Well, the Hajj goes against the vein of all of that. And, you know, the enemies, of course, who try to weaken Islam spirituality, who are weakening even Westerners themselves in terms of their morality and spirituality, they have this neoliberal material ideology, which again, the Hajj rejects. You can see the two pieces of cloth which Muslims wear at the Hajj, the simplicity of it, the beauty of it, and the circumambulation and the Kaaba all represent this kind of lack of materialism and this kind of alternative worldview. And I think that's what scares, certainly, the Zionist Western Empire, which is the primary problem creator across the globe today. And that's what actually empowers the resistance axis.
Muslims performing Hajj rituals in the Saudi city of Mecca celebrate Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, that marks the culmination of the annual pilgrimage. Pilgrims are now performing the Stoning of the Devil, a ceremony symbolizing complete obedience to God. They do that to the tent of city of Mina, close to Mecca, after staying the night there. The pilgrims will then slaughter a sacrificial animal. After that, they will go to the Grand Mosque in Mecca to perform a final tawaf of a circling around the Kaaba. This year's Hajj pilgrimage is the biggest since the COVID pandemic began. Some 1 million Muslims, including 850,000 from outside Saudi Arabia, are taking part. Hajj is one of the largest annual religious gatherings in the world. In the meantime, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are preparing for Eid al-Adha also. For the 16th time, this time under Israeli blockade, our correspondent Ashraf Shannon has more details.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip are preparing for Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, amid dire economic conditions. The sacred Muslim occasion comes at the end of the Hajj season, and it will be observed in Palestine on Saturday. Gazans have been observing Eid al-Adha under a tight Israeli siege since 2007. Muslims around the world buy new clothes, special gifts, and sweets for their loved ones on this festive occasion. But most Gazans can't afford such luxury.
We're trying to make our children happy during Eid, but things are really tough. Most of us are just going around the markets unable to afford Eid gifts for our families. The economic situation is very bad and has been getting worse by the year due to the blockade.
People are seen browsing the merchandise lining the streets and sidewalks of Gaza and hardly buying anything. They shop for long hours to try and find affordable gifts for their families.
During the holidays before the blockade, I used to buy a lot of clothes and gifts for my children, but nowadays I just buy them a few things. I have been coming to the market for 3 days now, trying to find something that I can afford.
According to UN figures, some 80% of Gazans depend on humanitarian aid to survive. Experts say the Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has devastated Gaza's economy and worsened the living conditions.
The Israeli blockade has been in place for a very long time and is the main reason for the weak purchasing power during Eid al-Adha. The majority of people in Gaza have a limited income, and more than 60% of the population suffers from poverty and unemployment. People are having a very hard time during the holidays, and they can hardly afford to put food on the table.
All happy occasions in this impoverished territory have been marred by the blockade and Israeli atrocities in recent years. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are preparing themselves for Eid al-Adha holiday, despite the dire straits facing them due to the Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
The United States will supply an extra $400 million worth of weapons to Ukraine amid the war in the country. The arms package includes four additional high-mobility artillery rocket systems, known as HIMARS, and more ammunition. Pentagon officials say the systems help Ukrainian forces strike Russian targets more precisely and at a longer range. They say these systems also disrupt Russia's ability to conduct artillery operations. Western countries, in particular the U.S., have announced billions of dollars of weapons shipments to Ukraine since the war began in February. Russia has repeatedly warned the West against providing Ukraine with weapons. It says that the arms deliveries amount to a proxy war by the U.S. and its allies against Moscow and prolongs the crisis. Our correspondent Johnny Miller in Donetsk explains how the much newly supplied Western weapons to Kiev can help the Ukrainian military in its fight against Russia.
Well, if these systems do get to the front line and they are operated by trained personnel, there's no doubt they can do serious damage to the Russian army. They're very long range, very precise. And they can do serious damage. But the problems for the Ukrainians and NATO, one is training these soldiers. That takes time. Getting to the front line is difficult because Russia hits weapons supplies all over the country. And then when they do get to the front line, they have to evade strikes from the Russians as well. But some of these NATO weapons have got to the front line, without doubt, have done some damage to the Russian army. But the Russians still seem very confident that they can combat anything that NATO can throw at them, because logistically it's just very hard to train up these troops, get them to the front line, and so they're able to turn the tide of the war. But NATO and Ukraine are still hoping that policy will work at some stage, but they haven't been able to. Well, they've slowed down the Russian advance, but they haven't yet been able to stop it. So we'll see whether these NATO weapons do make a difference. For months now, they haven't made a decisive difference, but NATO and Ukraine will be hoping that these new shipments do make a difference.
The race to replace outgoing UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson is heating up. Former UK Chancellor Rishi Sunak is the latest and most high-profile figure so far to throw his hat in the ring. In a video, Sunak said the UK faces serious challenges and he wants to restore trust or rebuild the economy and unite the country. His potential rivals for the Conservative Party leadership include Defence Secretary Ben Wallace, former Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt, and former Health Secretary Sajid Javid. Sunak resigned from the cabinet on Tuesday. That set in motion the mass walkout of ministers that forced Johnson to stand down as the Tory leader. He suffered a series of blows during his term, including the so-called Partygate scandal and a cost-of-living crisis.
Thank you. It is clearly now the will of the Parliamentary Conservative Party that there should be a new leader of that party and therefore a new Prime Minister.
Boris Johnson led his party to a landslide victory in the 2019 election. Little did he know he wouldn't even see through his first term, undone by multiple scandals and by flaws in his character that critics say made him unfit for office. The coronavirus pandemic offered Boris Johnson a perfect cocktail of crises and chaos that shifted attention from other problems.
Boris Johnson promised to get Brexit done, but nearly 2 years on, his country is still mired in a dispute with the European Union. The IMF says the UK will have the slowest economic growth of the G7 nations next year. Add to that the rising cost of living and also the faltering health and education systems.
Success with the vaccine program helped mitigate the frustration over Johnson's dithering and delays in following scientific advice that contributed to one of the highest death tolls in the developed world and almost took his life. His leadership style and character flaws always acted as ammunition for his critics and the opposition.
He's inflicted lies, fraud, and chaos in the country. And, you know, we're stuck with a government which isn't functioning in the middle of a cost of living crisis.
Then came the Partygate scandal. The Conservative Party was now in crisis. Johnson received wide support for his backing of the Ukrainian government in the ongoing military conflict in the country. But the Partygate scandal refused to go away. He received a police fine for attending one of multiple lockdown-breaching parties in Downing Street, becoming the first sitting British Prime Minister to have broken the law.
Mr. Speaker, I want to apologize.
Eventually, 148 of his own MPs, 40% of the parliamentary party, turned against him in a vote of no confidence. He survived it and staggered on. And then it emerged he had known about this man, Chris Pincher's, sexual misconduct and appointed him to a powerful position still. Within days, the man nicknamed the Great Political Survivor was forced to throw in the towel. Saeed Pourizza, London.
Sri Lankan authorities have reimposed a curfew in the capital, Colombo, as a public outrage grows over the country's worst economic crisis. The students began their rally from a university on the outskirts of the city, marching towards the presidential palace in the heart of the commercial hub. On Saturday, protesters again took to the streets of Colombo in defiance of the curfew. Sri Lanka has been crippled with a shortage of foreign exchange that has left it struggling to pay for food, fuel, and medicine. The island nation has sought an International Monetary Fund bailout to secure funds for essential commodities. And about an hour ago, we spoke to Jihan Pera, chief of the Sri Lankan National Peace Council. He joined us from the middle of the protests in Colombo and explained why people are so outraged and what they want.
since it's the second month anniversary, people have spontaneously decided through WhatsApp and social media that they are all going to converge near the president's office and demand his resignation. What you're hearing, when they are shouting, go ta, go home, that means they are demanding that the president should go home. And they also want the government to resign. And I think the government, but the previous prime minister, he tried to stabilize the old government. But now I think the time has come for an all-party, interim, short-term government to be appointed to try and deal with the worst of the economic crisis, to negotiate with the IMF, to get support from friendly countries, to show that we are united as a government, as a people. We are united, we are not fighting each other anymore, and to get the assistance we need, and then hold elections after about 6 months. That's the dream we have at the moment.
People in Japan mourn the death of former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe a day after he was shot dead in the western city of Nara. Mourners visited the scene of Abe's assassination, putting flowers there to show respect for him. Earlier today, a hearse carrying Abe's body arrived at his residence in the capital, Tokyo. Abe was the longest-serving Prime Minister of Japan. He was shot during an election campaign rally ahead of the Sunday upper house vote and later died in hospital. The suspect is in custody and has confessed to assassinating Abe. His motivation? A belief that Abe was linked to an unspecified group. The killing sent shockwaves across Japan and the world. Iran has called it a terror attack and strongly condemned it. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
False claims about the 2020 presidential election and the House Select Committee's January 6 investigation featured prominently during the Republican Wyoming primary debate as Representative Liz Cheney faced off against four challengers, including the Donald Trump-backed Harriet Hateman. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Ewan Palmer. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled Liz Cheney and Trump-backed Challenger Clash at Wyoming GOP Debate. False claims about the 2020 presidential election and the House Select Committee's January 6 investigation featured prominently during the Republican Wyoming primary debate as Representative Liz Cheney faced off against four challengers, including the Donald Trump-backed Harriet Hageman. The debate, hosted by Wyoming PBS, saw Liz Cheney, Harriet Hageman, Robin Belinsky, Senator Anthony Bouchard and Denton Knapp discuss a number of issues ahead of the August 16 primary, including how to deal with rising inflation and infrastructure development. However, it was the 2020 presidential election and the House Select Committee's investigation into the riot at the U.S. Capitol, of which Liz Cheney is a vice chair, that dominated proceedings. Liz Cheney, who is fighting for a political future after being censured by the Republican National Committee and the Wyoming GOP voting to no longer recognize her as part of the party due to her role on the January 6 panel and criticism of Donald Trump, fought accusations from Harriet Hageman that the panel was not relevant to the people of Wyoming. "We have a committee in Congress right now. They're focusing on something that happened 18 months ago," Hageman said. "They're not focusing on the issues that are important to the people in Wyoming, and they're also ignoring the corruption that is absolutely destroying Washington, D.C., and as a result, taking down the rest of the country." Liz Cheney, one of just two Republicans on the January 6 committee, defended her role on the House panel and continued her attacks on Hageman and former President Donald Trump. "There's a real tragedy that's occurring, and the tragedy is that there are politicians in this country, beginning with Donald Trump, who have lied to the American people, and people have been betrayed," Cheney said. She added, "He consistently has said that the election was stolen when it wasn't." Liz Cheney also noted how former Trump campaign manager Bill Stepien, who is now an advisor to Harriet Hageman's campaign, testified to the January 6 panel that Donald Trump had no basis to declare himself the winner on election night in November of 2020, before all the votes had been counted. Liz Cheney said, "I'd be interested to know whether or not my opponent, Ms. Hageman, is willing to say here tonight that the election was not stolen. She knows it wasn't stolen. I think that she can't say that it wasn't stolen because she's completely beholden to Donald Trump." Liz Cheney again urged Harriet Hageman to admit she supports Trump's false claim about the 2020 election elsewhere during the debate. "Hageman is standing up here claiming that the election was stolen or that there was fraud. That was sufficient to overturn the election," Cheney said. "She ought to say it, otherwise she needs to stop making claims that are not true, and she ought to tell the people of Wyoming the truth." While Harriet Hageman did not directly say she believed that the last election was stolen from Donald Trump by voter fraud, an unfounded accusation that has been debunked multiple times, She did say she shared concerns about its legitimacy that other Americans have. Hageman referenced highly disputed claims about the use of drop boxes made in the conspiracy theory-riddled documentary 2000 Mules, created by right-wing political commentator Dinesh D'Souza, as a great concern. According to an internal opinion poll from a pro-Hageman group released in June, the Trump-backed candidate has the support of 56% of voters, compared to 28% who said they would back Liz Cheney. Liz Cheney has managed to raise millions more dollars than Harriet Hageman during her re-election campaign. However, a significant amount of the money is coming from out of state and from those who cannot vote for her. The debate on Thursday, 30th of June, was not open to the public after one of the candidates received death threats, according to Wyoming PBS.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has issued a message on the occasion of the annual Hajj pilgrimage, calling for unity among Muslims in the face of plots to create divisions in the Islamic world. The leader said, enemies have long strived to sow division and undermine spirituality among Muslims. Ayatollah Khamenei, however, said the Islamic world is today ready to foil such plots. He also hailed what he called the stability, independence, progress, and honor of the Islamic Republic of Iran as a meaningful phenomenon that can attract the thoughts of every conscious Muslim. 1 million Muslims, mostly from outside Saudi Arabia, are taking part in this year's Hajj pilgrimage. That's the biggest since the start of the COVID pandemic. Joining us on Spotlight, we have journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas, joining us from the British capital, London. And from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Chajid, who's also joining us from the British capital.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas in London. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has issued a message on the annual event of the Hajj pilgrimage calling for unity among Muslims. Talk to us about the significance of the Hajj pilgrimage and with it the importance of Islamic unity.
Well, of course, the aspect of Hajj, which everybody's very familiar with, is this kind of devotion and submission to the divine. It's almost like an oath of allegiance that one goes back and replenishes. And of course, there's that whole spiritual element of seeking forgiveness from the divine, locking into one's own inner, if you like, connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But that, in a way, I mean, Ayatollah Khamenei has kind of subtly alluded to this, is only part of what the Hajj is about. Yet it's the part of the Hajj which actually has been, for maybe centuries, been propagated as being the only aspect of Hajj, you know, the ritual, religious, devotional aspect. There is another aspect which Grand Ayatollah Khamenei has kind of consistently, it's not just this year, he's consistently reminded people that Hajj also has a social and a political aspect. Hajj is really not only in terms of unity and harmony, which he talks about, something which links the Muslim world to the realities of their time, because unity means not only unity amongst Muslims, it means unity also with humanity on the basis of prophetic moral virtues and ethics. Now, that's a huge aspect of the whole notion of the unity at the Hajj. The Hajj itself, of course, is an array of every kind of ethnicity, every kind of class or any every kind of geographical location living individual. It knows no difference between men and women. It's a real, of course, an absolute physical example of the lack of division and the pure coming together of humanity. So in that sense, of course, he's trying to project that a little further and alluding to the situation, particularly of West Asia, but beyond. And what he's hinted very clearly is that there is a wholesale attack on traditional prophetic values, and that would mean across the world. And there are attacks being launched by organized neoliberal, neoconservative institutions and the financiers behind those institutions. And they're destroying the fundamental values of society as we know them, everything from the family through to our governments and our systems and our relationships and even our own perceptions of our own genders and ourselves. You know, these are all things that are under attack. Gender fluidity is a big thing. The whole idea of you know, sexual hypersexuality, if you like, or hypermaterialism, is a thing which specifically the West exports. And he's obviously clearly saying that the Hajj represents an opportunity for us to A, reject all of that division and all of that materialism. I mean, materialism is okay, but unless it's grounded in spirituality and the good of humanity, it becomes an evil which we're basically being rolled out on a huge scale, where billionaires become more like trillionaires, and the poor become even poorer. And at this stage is where Islam needs to start not just looking at itself as some sort of ritualistic religion which deals with people's devotion and afterlife, but rather it has to come into what it really is, which is a deen, a way of life, a complete way of life. So I think what Ayatollah Khamenei pointed to here is about this kind of miraculous phenomena of resistance, which is increasingly emerging as the alternative to hypermaterial, secular, neoliberal imperialism.
Master Shajar also joining us from the British capital, London. Mr. Shajar, the leader, he said enemies have long strived to sow division and undermine spirituality among Muslims. Who benefits from these divisions?
Well, colonial power and the arrogance of Western colonial power have always been using divide and rule as a tool to implement their policies all around the world. And now it's no different. The only difference is that now it's very clear Islam is the only major ideology which challenges this colonial abuses around the world, and indeed is being targeted because of that. After the fall of Soviet Union and sort of communism becoming irrelevant to some extent, Islam is the only ideology which is challenging the status quo, and it's being targeted because of that. You'll see sort of the effort that is being put into Islamophobia, demonization of Islam, and using sort of every media and every opportunity to create a sort of Western friendly Islam, an Islam which separates the religion from the politics and the economics and everything else. It's something that, as you know, the West have been involved in for a very long time. A sort of Islam that is compatible with the colonial needs and aspiration. And this we see that. And also, it's not a secret that everyone, all the Muslims, and indeed even those who see themselves as enemies of Islam, agree that for Islam to be successful, you need unity. You need purpose, you need direction. And this is exactly what Ayatollah Khamenei has been urging for a very long time. And, you know, the power will not come to Muslim world by the sort of the direction of sitting down having cups of coffee with the U.S. president or sitting down and being abused like the prince did with Trump, or indeed having nuclear weapons like Pakistan has. The reality is that only way that a government will become powerful is by being independent, not allowing itself to be manipulated, to have a direction, the direction of bringing people together, empowering the Muslim community to create a better and juster society, not just for Muslims, but for everyone else. That is the only winning card, and we need to emphasize that. This is what Islam is all about. Islam is not sure. about sort of keeping the hierarchical structure and just putting Muslim on top so they will abuse everybody else. Islam is about removing the oppressors and empowering the oppressed.
Okay. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, you, in our previous question, you mentioned the issue of resistance. Ayatollah Khamenei named Palestine as one of the manifestations of resistance, as it has been able to, quote, bring down the rebellious Zionist regime from its state of aggression. How crucial is the issue of Palestine regarding Muslim nations' unity, and how fundamental is the issue of Palestine when we talk about resistance against oppression?
I think it's absolutely pivotal. Ayatollah Khomeini himself made Al-Quds Day a particular day of remembrance for all of the oppressed of the world, but he utilized Al-Quds and Palestine as the symbol of that aspiration of liberating the oppressed from the oppressors. And he very clearly, you know, it has, well, Iran and Ayatollah Khamenei have very clearly continued that process. And the results and the fruits of that can actually be seen. You know, he's mentioned Palestine, and it's very true. There were the days when Israel would go raging into Palestinian territories with no worries. They don't do that anymore. They have to use airplanes, bomb a few places, and then stop. They're not able to even trigger their own dome defense systems to prevent missiles and rockets, the most rudimentary rockets, from entering their territories, as we saw in the last conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. Now, this is the result, really, of, first of all, Iran's steadfastness, because Iran's advancement in technology, its advancement in scientific fields, its advancement in terms of a resistance economy, in creating a self-reliance in terms of being able to produce its own, its ability to reject the maximum pressure of the United States and the entire West, its ability to reject even the British, the Bank of International Settlements, and to stay out of their grip. All of this is nothing short of a miraculous kind of resistance. And you see, what's really fascinating is that model has then been looked at by many, many movements, but the ones that have manifested in their own way and shape in different places are quite important to look at. So the first one of these resistance manifestations you'd point to straight away is Hezbollah in Lebanon and their protection of the Lebanese independence and sovereignty and their head-on struggle against the Zionist military and other invasive, if you like, aggressive actions. They are on the front line and have successfully twice repelled Israeli efforts to invade Lebanon and to occupy it. So that's one model. And that model, mind you, didn't start as a military model. It began really as a social model, a model where the leaders of Hezbollah actually nurtured a social welfare system, hospitals, providing aid, providing people, all sorts of things that they required in their villages that they weren't getting in their townships. And that's what actually Hezbollah is primarily about. Israel, of course, has turned it into also a militarily defensive force because of its belligerence. But move on to, say, someone like Sheikh Zakzaki in Nigeria, another man hugely influenced by the Islamic Revolution and the system of Iran, Velayat-e Faqih, which is specific to the Islamic Republic of Iran. But he has a movement of peace, absolutely peaceful movement in Nigeria, where his people get regularly murdered and killed by the dictatorial Buhari regimes and the murderous tyranny that exists there. Then move on, my point is that yet there, nonetheless, that movement lives and survives and it's growing rapidly. I'll just give one more example. In Iraq today, it wouldn't exist had the model of the Islamic Republic of Iran not been certified and backed up by Ayatollah Sistani, for instance, and the creation of the PNUs, you know, and their repulsion of the proxy agents called ISIS, the proxies of Zionist Western imperialism. So those are just three blatant examples, which you can see. I could go on to Syria. I could talk about many other areas. Yemen itself, of course, is another prime example of how the resistance has taken note of the models of the Islamic Republic of Iran about resistance to this imperial arrogance. And you see in every one of those fields, you will see that the resistance is more than holding its own. And if it wasn't for this huge amount of money and the technical and military, arsenal which these arrogant powers are throwing at these wars, you'd see that these people would have been long liberated. But I think that process has certainly begun, and the mindset of Muslims, as Ayatollah Khamenei says, is beginning to change into one of confidence and hope from being one of totally subjugated vassals of the Zionist imperialist empire.
Sure. Masoud Shajad, Islamic self-awareness has created a wondrous, miraculous phenomenon in the very heart of the Islamic world, and this poses serious problems for the arrogant powers. Those are the words of Ayatollah Khamenei. He called the name of this phenomenon resistance. He added other brilliant examples of Islamic resistance can be clearly seen in Lebanon, Iraq, and elsewhere. What is the main characteristic of this Islamic resistance?
Well, you can't separate Islam from the resistance. I mean, the reality is that Islam, being a political, social, economical, and a spiritual...
I mean, Mr. Shajada, we're experiencing some technical difficulties. We'll get back to you as soon as that's fixed. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, while we get back to Mr. Shajada, I'd like to bring up another point, and that's a segment of the leader's message focused on Iran as well. He hailed what he called the stability, independence, progress, and honor of the Islamic Republic as a meaningful phenomenon that can attract the thoughts of every conscious Muslim. All of that mentioned, as we know, is happening amidst the U.S. sanctions and its so-called maximum pressure campaign, which makes Iran's advancements and the country's progress even more substantial and more impressive, doesn't it?
I think absolutely. I mean, I often say this. I think it's a miracle that the Islamic Republic of Iran has been able to resist all these economic sanctions and went that path, and the people's sacrifice and the sacrifice of the leadership is something that history will only really fully acknowledge many, many years after this period is over. But it really is the first time that a nation of this kind has been able to resist the arrogant powers kind of prerogatives. You know, when the World Bank and when the American Army and when the Bank of International Settlements and the World Bank and all these other agencies, when they set to work on destroying a nation, they're usually pretty good at it, and they usually bring it to its knees one way or another, economic, military, or otherwise. But according to Ayatollah Khamenei, he says, I mean, I'll quote, the sovereignty of Islam in the legislative and executive branches of governance, reliance on the vote of the people in the country's most important administrative matters, complete political independence, and a refusal to rely on any oppressive powers are among the basic principles in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, that, for me, it packs everything in there. First of all, you've got to have a model. When you tell a people, look, you've got to rebel against the system, i.e. the neoliberal Western imperialist system, the first thing people think in their minds is, well, if we rebel, first of all, will we get killed? Will we get, annihilated? The second is, what's the alternative? Well, you know, the Islamic Republic has given an answer to both. First of all, if you're going to rebel against an immoral, corrupt system, then the reality is that God is with you, and Islam tells us very clearly that martyrdom leads to paradise. So this is something which is at the heart of this resistance movement and the heart of Iran's own resistance, particularly. And the other aspect is, when people ask you, okay, what's the alternative to neoliberal capitalism? Well, Iran has genuinely now offered a system which involves the people, which has an oversight from wise basira or insightful jurisprudence and other experts. They've also given a system which actually allows for the morality of the West to be checked. And that system has delivered ultimately under the worst circumstances a set of, if you like, results, which I can quote from the universities of medical students to and the increase in all of that field, the whole expansion of universities in Iran. I can quote the advancement in everything from biomedical developments through to drone and military hardware. And all of them, Iran is becoming one of the most excellent in all these fields. Now, women's advance within the education system, their involvement in the field of work and development of Iran mustn't be ignored. All of these things are just the tip of the iceberg of all the successes that the Islamic Republic of Iran has been able to deliver practically. Now, who's watching? All of these other nations like the Saudis who've been throwing money upon money, they've had zillions of dollars of oil wealth, which they flitted away into real estates in America, created no infrastructures, no industry, created no self-independence, no sovereignty. All they've done is exactly what their Zionist and American
Said Mohsen Abbas, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to jump in there. We've got Mr. Shajada back with us from London, and we're going to put our final question to Mr. Shajada. You can finish where you left off about the previous question about Islamic resistance, but I'm also going to put another question for you, and if you can, give us a brief answer. One of the key points of today's address was the mentioning of the failures of the U.S. and the Israeli regime. Ayatollah Khamenei said, "The distress and failure of the United States and its criminal accomplice, the usurper regime in the region, can clearly be seen." Are these failures now piling up, and are they becoming more and more evident, in your opinion?
Absolutely. I think the world is awakening to the reality which Islamic Republic, through this revolution, identified. The sort of Zionists are now exposed, and they're being identified very clearly. An apartheid state. Apartheid state has got certain legal connotation. It has to be challenged by all nations, and it cannot be revived. It has to be removed. It cannot be fixed, and it cannot be changed. It really has to be removed, like it did when South Africa got rid of the apartheid system, and then people could begin, whites and black, living together in harmony. Same thing has to happen in occupied Palestine. And so the people of the region and in the occupied territories could begin putting their lives back together.
Sure.
U.S. is policy is bankrupt. Look what is happening Ukraine. Look
thank
what
you,
is happening.
Thank you, Mr. Shajada. Yeah, we're fresh out of time for this segment of the program. Allow me to thank my guest, journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas, joining us from the British capital, London. And thanks to Islamic Human Rights from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masood Shajada, also joining us from the British capital. A special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, Allah, Allah.
Today's tip, why do we have a lack of attention and focus in our ubudiyah, our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to Allah?
Allah, 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 Rabbi.
So, dear listeners, we are humbly talking about why sometimes there is a lack of attention in our ubudiyah, in our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to Allah. Now, of course, I'm sure that some of us, if not many of us, has felt that sometimes in our formal and even informal forms of ubudiyah, we tend to have a lack of attention or lack of focus in what we're doing. Now, why do we have this lack of attention in our ubudiyah, our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to Allah? Yes, a lot of us suffer from this, but why do we suffer from this? Now, many times all we have to do is a little bit of reflection and we realize why is it that we have a lack of attention while we are conducting these different acts of worship and obedience to Allah. Of course, when it comes to formal ubudiyah, we have the five daily prayers or the recitation of the Qur'an or the recitation of various du'as and supplications and litanies and such. And we find that we don't give the due attention that we are supposed to. Well, one of the things that happens that causes us to have a lack of attention, of course, is having worries and being busy in thinking about the different problems, trials, tribulations, calamities, difficulties that we face in our lives. Now, when our mind is busy with these worries and calculations and situations, then, of course, our heart is also busy in these kind of affairs, and likewise, our soul will become busy in these worries and trying to figure out what we need to do. When, in fact, we are standing in front of the Almighty Allah, we're going to take the Salah, the five daily prayers, as an example. When we are going to begin the Salah, the five daily prayers, right, this namaz, we should not be thinking about all these problems and these worries. Now, if we go a little bit deeper into this idea of why are we so worried, it kind of goes back to a lack of trust in the Almighty Allah. We worry about, for example, our livelihood. Well, if we try hard enough, will Allah not give us our livelihood? Or we worry about the future. If we try hard enough, will Allah not help us in our future? or we're worried about an exam, or we are worried about our family life, or we are worried about the future of our children, or we are worried about this and that. Well, if we try hard enough, and I want to make sure that this is one of the things that is understood, that the first step, or at least one of the steps, is that we must try ourselves to fix our problems, and the rest we leave up to Allah, that what we weren't able to fulfill despite our efforts, Allah will fulfill and will help us to make up for those flaws and those errors. So if we remove these worries from our mind and our heart and our soul, we will be able to focus more and pay attention in our ubudiyya.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
أجب دعائي يا رجائي بالرضا والخير أنر طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
And now we invite you to listen to Brother Nu'man Ali Khan.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا اركعوا واسجدوا واعبدوا ربكم وافعلوا الخير لعلكم تفلحون.
Let me teach you what you will do to appreciate Allah. Here's how you appreciate Allah. Make ruku', make sajda. What is both of these things referring to? Salat. You need to appreciate me. The first step in appreciating me will be salat. Where's your salat? How much we appreciate our salat is a good indication of how much we appreciate Allah. How active, how vigilant we are in getting up out of bed. How lazy we feel in making it to the masjid. How bored we are when the recitation is not entertaining enough. All of those are good indicators of where we stand before Allah Azza wa Jalla. You know, somebody who doesn't know about prayer, doesn't know about the Muslim prayer, a non-Muslim guy walks by and he sees people making salat. He's going to notice these people are standing with their head down. They're humble before somebody. Then they put their heads down like this halfway. Wow, they got even more humble. And when they got up, what happened next? Face on the ground, they got really humble. In other words, he's noticing that there's a progression in their humility to Allah, to whoever they're worshipping. They're getting even more and more and more subservient. This seems like they're appreciating their master, and they appreciated him more, and they appreciated him even more. The progression of salat itself teaches us that we're supposed to evolve, grow in our humility to Allah. So this idea that the more we serve, the more we're going to become humble. The extreme of humility, wasjudu. Then from there, because these two things still in the end, in essence, refer to salat. They refer to salat.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Welcome back to your listeners in continuation to what we were saying, which was, of course, trying to answer this question about why it is that we have a lack of attention in our servitude, in our obedience, in our worship, and in our